Hello, welcome to Entwine Podcast. Before we dive into episode 21, I wanted to take a few moments to say thank you for listening to the show. So thank you. I've covered a lot of this on my last episode, but it's important for you to know we appreciate you taking the time out of your day to hear our stories. We absolutely love getting your feedback, so keep it coming. If you want to support the show, there are a few easy ways to make that happen. The first, which is super simple, is to head on over to patreon.com/entwined and get signed up. The second way is just as easy. If you like the show, then tell a friend, tell your neighbor, heck, tell all your neighbors. And if you're shy, don't worry about it. You can just tell your diary. We're good with that too. Just go ahead and get the word out there. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, YouTube, and Instagram. Entwine Podcast. You can find us. Last but not least is to log into iTunes and drop us a review. Remember, we're not begging for good reviews here. Just help us capture a few honest ones. So, yeah, that's about it. Thank you very much. Enjoy the show and stay twined. Entwined is a podcast about how so much of the world around us is wound or twisted together. This podcast strives to lay bare unexposed or indiscernible connections using historical and anecdotal sources. I am Elliot Gladstone, and alongside P.S. McKay, this is Entwined. You don't have to be a kid to look up to someone, or to have dreams of being just like your favorite athlete, movie star, or public figure. Kids do it best. They don't harbor any embarrassment or fear of sharing that when they grow up, they hope to be the next Steve Jobs, Hillary Clinton, LeBron James, or Giada De Laurentiis. As kids, sharing these dreams is really just a part of the growing up process, and although being just like mom or dad is acceptable, they prefer to set more of a stretch goal. For adults, well, it tends to go a little differently. Sure, we have hopes and dreams just like the tiny versions of ourselves, but as we grow into adults, those dreams, those hopes either become reality or get pushed further and further away. Being inspired is truly a magnificent thing. Somewhere a kid is running around her home, pretending to be a firefighter as she runs up and down the stairs, attempting to rescue dolls and Barbies from an imaginary five-alarm fire. Somewhere else, a group of children pull together a pickup game, each trying to live out the kind of end-of-game scenario that requires last-minute heroics. And surely there is someone somewhere, mashing away on an adding machine, preparing for an exciting future at the Internal Revenue Service. Probably. The point of the matter is that everyone young or old and everywhere in between uses the successes or failures of others as part of their roadmap through life. Theodore Teddy Roosevelt grew up as part of a wealthy family who found themselves attending church services with Mary and Abraham Lincoln. A young Theodore Roosevelt looked up to President Lincoln, which would continue for the balance of his life. This admiration was no secret. In fact, he shared this sentiment with his friends in a letter from 1906, where he referred to the president as "my great hero." Roosevelt wanted to become a president of the people with all the genius and admiration of Abraham Lincoln. It was his dream. Lincoln was his inspiration. The road to the White House was a rough, tumultuous, cruel path that would have provoked weakness in even the most determined individuals. This road began in the middle of 1865 in a bustling New York City while Teddy was just a six-year-old boy. President Abraham Lincoln had recently been assassinated, and his coffin was visiting some of the larger cities in the Union. Being born into a wealthy family put Roosevelt's childhood home right along the parade route, and he and brother Elliot watched from a second-story window as people mourned the loss of a great American president. Surprisingly, there is a picture of this moment, and although you can't quite make out individual faces, you can definitely see the two young boys peering out the window of the Roosevelt Mansion. Several years later, he met and married Alice Hathaway Lee while attending Harvard, and the two would have one child. Unfortunately, this was not a long-lasting relationship. Just 2 short days after the birth of their daughter, Alice passed away from complications of Bright's disease, which is a kidney disorder. On the very same day, actually, just a few hours apart, and in the same home, Theodore Roosevelt lost his mother to typhoid fever. Teddy would be left to raise his daughter alone, which proved to be too much to handle. He decided to leave his daughter in the care of his sister and abandon his job in public service at the New York Assembly. He needed to escape. He decided to flee his life and found peace in the Badlands of North Dakota. Roosevelt spent 2 years hunting, living off the land and chasing outlaws out of town. These were seriously hard times for Roosevelt, and he never spoke of his wife again. He only returned to New York out of necessity, as most of his cattle died in the winter of 1886. Now that he was back in familiar company, he managed to rekindle a relationship with his childhood sweetheart. So much rekindling happened that the two would quickly marry. He then forged his way back into public service and would hold many positions, including sheriff, assistant secretary of the U.S. Navy, governor, and eventually vice president. In 1900, Theodore Roosevelt would run an aggressive campaign to become the vice president. This may seem weird, awkward, or even stupid to some of you, but the presidential candidates haven't always been able to select their vice president. The Republican convention chose Roosevelt as the vice presidential candidate because Garrett Hobarth, the candidate from the prior election, had passed away from heart failure. Looking back to when the United States was just a little kid, the person with the most votes became the president, and the person who received the second most votes became the vice president. This created some crazy outcomes because it was possible for an American to have a Democrat as a president and a Republican in the number two position. Don't believe it? Go ask John Adams. I'm sure he could talk for hours on the subject. Another fun moment was when Thomas Jefferson ran against Aaron Burr, and the two men ended up with the same number of electoral votes. What to do about this? Well, the House voted, and the number of votes were evenly split for each candidate, which tends to make sense considering the two men had the same number of electoral votes. The House voted a total of 35 times and were unable to determine a winner until finally the stalemate faltered and Jefferson was elected president. His vice president? Yep, that would be Aaron Burr. Imagine what the war room must have been like. This eventually caused folks to push for reform, which resulted in the 12th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The new amendment stated that each elector shall cast a ballot for both president and vice president, which created the path for Roosevelt to be elected in the election of 1900, and more importantly, how we decide elections today. Theodore Roosevelt was vice president for only a short time, because just like Abraham Lincoln, President McKinley was killed by an assassin in 1901. This thrust Roosevelt into the White House, and he would become the 26th president, as well as the youngest man to ever hold the position. Teddy would follow in the footsteps of his idol, Abraham Lincoln, as president, but it was what he did in the years to come that would really help define his place in history. Abraham Lincoln was a hero to many, and I'd like to imagine kids from the same generation playing president and pretending to give speeches in tribute to a great American. I mean, this probably happened because Lincoln inspired so many men and women over the years. another American who found inspiration in the life and career of President Abraham Lincoln was a man by the name of Henry Leland. Henry Leland had an interesting career which never crossed into politics like the man he had so much respect for. Leland had a sound mechanical mind and grew up during the Civil War, reached voting age just at the right time to cast a vote for his hero, Abraham Lincoln. He focused his talents on manufacturing and founded a company whose bread and butter was in precision manufacturing. He was so good that he found himself the recruiting target of several companies and even the government over the years. Right after Roosevelt was sworn in as president, Leland was brought on to value the assets of the Henry Ford Company after Henry Ford, the founder, was forced out by investors. Okay, let's pause here for just a moment. The founder, Henry Ford, for whom the company was named, was no longer part of the organization which carried his name. Leland disapproved of the idea to liquidate the company, which due to its size was a very public process, and advised investors to reorganize and take a shot at building a new style of automobile. Leland proved convincing, and in an extremely short time, like less than 60 days, the Henry Ford Company officially became the Cadillac Automobile Company. The project was tremendous and an instant success, and the new Cadillac started to fly off showroom floors. Any guesses on how Leland and friends came up with the name of the new company? Okay, so this is really a whole separate entwined, but the company derived its name from the French explorer who is credited with founding the city of Detroit, which is where Cadillac based its operations. The jury is split on whether or not the explorer slash adventurer was actually a hero or a scoundrel. In 1909, General Motors was in the business of buying companies and took interest in the growing Cadillac. The investors appointed Henry Leland to negotiate with the founder of General Motors, a man by the name of William Crapo Durant. Durant was a beast in the boardroom, and in the true tradition of selling cars, he went back and forth with Leland until the deal was done. So Cadillac becomes part of GM, and it is the only successful arm of its parent company. Then, just a few short years later, Leland would leave the company he helped create. But why? Because Leland and Durant disagreed at their core on what role the company would play in World War I. Leland felt strongly about the United States' role in the war and felt that a portion of manufacturing should be reserved to build aircraft engines. Durant was a pacifist and would not permit any military contracts, and Henry Leland resigned from his post at General Motors. Okay, so this is where it gets fun. Remember how Henry Leland idolized Abraham Lincoln? Just after leaving GM, Henry Leland worked with other investors to create the Lincoln Motor Company with the sole purpose of building aircraft engines, but more specifically, the Liberty V-12 water-cooled aircraft engine to help in the war effort. An engine that, by the way, was wrought with controversy. In fact, a man by the name of Gutzon Borglum called for an investigation into the delays in large-scale quality production of the Liberty V-12 engine. Gutzon was passionate, as many artists are, but his accusations lacked substance and were limited on facts, which never amounted to anything. But more on Gutzon later. Government contracts have a way of growing businesses, and Leland was able to parlay the successful partnership back into the auto business with the release of the Lincoln Model L, which was met with very little success. With no wars being fought and the demand for aircraft engines in decline, the company began to struggle and was in danger of collapse. Then get this, guess who comes in and saves the day? None other than Henry Ford himself. Yeah. Henry Ford. So Leland came in after Ford was kicked out of the Henry Ford Company and helped him make it great again. And now here was Ford, basically in a position to do the exact same thing for Leland. Only difference was Ford was bitter from what happened 20 years before, and as a result, he coordinated the purchase of the Lincoln Motor Company for half of its projected worth. Now, I just want to take a hot second to drive home a pretty significant piece of automotive history. So here it is. The Henry Ford Company became Cadillac. Cadillac was bought by GM. So essentially, what we know today as General Motors started out as Ford. World War I politics spawned the Lincoln Motor Company, which was then bought out by the Ford Motor Company. Incredible, right? Okay, so now part of the Ford Motor Company, Lincoln was immediately dismantled and the employees were ousted. Henry Ford was aggressive in cutting ties with Lincoln management, but made sure to preserve the relationships Leland had forged with the government, as the United States would end up being just a few short years away from entering World War II. One of the engines that Ford built during World War II was the Pratt & Whitney R2800 radial aircraft engine, which would be found in the F-6F Hellcat, a plane designed to be flown in the South Pacific to combat the smaller and faster Japanese planes. Many of the F-6F Hellcats were deployed from aircraft carriers, such as the USS Enterprise. Okay, a few interesting things here. The first is that there are several ships that have been designated the USS Enterprise over the years, but the one operating in the South Pacific during World War II was the Enterprise CV-6, which was retired in 1947. Another version of the Enterprise carried the designation CVN-65 and was retired in 2013. Currently, a new USS Enterprise is being built, which will be designated CVN-80. And is due out in the year 2525, if man is still alive. Catch the reference? Bonus points if you did. There are others, most notably the USS Enterprise, which boldly goes where no man has gone before. But that is clearly a different show. The second interesting fact has to do with the term USS. Turns out this actually means something, and it is abbreviation which stands for United States Ship. The formula is a common way to designate naval vessels for many countries. For example, in Great Britain, the ship names start with HMS, which in turn means Her Majesty's Ship. Okay, back to the USS Enterprise. So, the Ford Motor Company, minus Henry Leland, was building engines being used in F-6F Hellcats, which were being flown off the deck of the Enterprise. The United States hadn't officially entered the war, but it had military might posted all around the globe in the event it would be called or forced into action. The USS Enterprise was stationed in Hawaii, and leading up to the war was used as a halfway point for aircraft being shuttled around the South Pacific. The ship and its crew were on their way back to Oahu when bad weather delayed their December 6th estimated arrival date. The weather was so bad that the ship was still 150 miles away when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. As one of the surviving ships from a date which will remain in infamy, the ship's captain immediately received orders to search and destroy the Japanese fleet, which was suspected to have launched the attack. Franklin D. Roosevelt was the elected president at the time of the attack, and is a cousin of Theodore Roosevelt. His wife, the First Lady, you may remember being a woman named Eleanor Roosevelt. Fun tidbit here, Eleanor's father was sitting with Theodore in the second story window of the Roosevelt Mansion as Abraham Lincoln's funeral procession passed by so many years before. Her father was Teddy's brother, Elliot. The family relationship gets a little weird here because Eleanor was basically Teddy's niece and Franklin was Teddy's cousin. This makes Eleanor and Franklin fifth cousins once removed. Incidentally, Eleanor would have the same maiden name as married name. Anyway, I digress. The attack on Pearl Harbor was devastating, and it was at this time Franklin Roosevelt addressed the people of the world.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan.
This moment was significant for obvious reasons. So many people, so many brothers, fathers, and sons died that day who had answered the call to be part of something our forefathers helped create. Many of these men were part of the first peacetime draft of 1940, and still others enlisted voluntarily. They enlisted or registered inspired by something significant, and after December 7th, it became clear Americans were ready to stand together so future generations would be able to live out their dreams of one day becoming something great. One American who elected to sign up after the bombing was a man named Jack Crawford Taylor. Jack Taylor signed up to be part of the U.S. Navy and ended up flying the F-6F Hellcat on missions off of the USS Enterprise. The F-6F Hellcat was so effective in dogfights with the Japanese that there are entire websites created to chronicle the success of the pilots who flew them. To give you an idea of how prolific these pilots were, their best aviator who tops the list downed 34 Japanese planes during the Second World War. Taylor doesn't land on this list, but he did fly well enough to earn the Distinguished Flying Cross. Twice. I looked it up because it sounded fancy, and basically the Distinguished Flying Cross is awarded for heroism or extraordinary achievement while participating in aerial flight. So, yeah, fancy. After his time with the military, Taylor returned to the States to start a family. Jack Taylor looked to the auto industry to get started in a new career, which leveraged the responsibility and work ethic he learned in the Navy. Taylor eventually started a small Cadillac dealership in St. Louis, which he would say was a risk a lot less frightening after the experience of landing a Hellcat on the moving deck of an aircraft carrier. Taylor brought a new concept to the world of car sales, and the dealership started offering leasing options to their customers. In its infancy, the company was called Executive Leasing. But after a few successful years of operations, the company grew into the giant it is today. You see, Jack Crawford Taylor named his business after the aircraft carrier he spent so much time on during World War II. Taylor created the rental giant now known today as Enterprise Rent-A-Car, which was named after the USS Enterprise. Now, I mentioned Gutzon Borglum when discussing the Lincoln-built Leland Liberty V-12 engines earlier in the episode. Gutzon isn't affiliated with Enterprise Rent-A-Car or the USS Enterprise, but he does have a pretty relevant connection to our story. In addition to opposing the V-12 engine for its quality issues, Borglum was an artist, and a famous one at that. He was famous for sculpting a bust of Abraham Lincoln, which was able to be displayed in Theodore Roosevelt's White House. In fact, Borglum was quite the sculptor and did work for Thomas Paine, the Daughters of the Confederacy, and his friend Woodrow Wilson. The production of so many amazing sculptures started to get him noticed on a much larger scale, and in 1927, he was commissioned to carve a giant piece of rock in South Dakota, which we now refer to as the Mount Rushmore National Memorial. The memorial has grown into a symbol of freedom and hope and will continue for generations to come. I am sure everyone knows, but just to be on the safe side, let's quickly cover who is portrayed on this elaborate sculpture in South Dakota. All right, I'm going to go from left to right so you can get a visual. Okay, so starting on the left side, there's George Washington, then his buddy Thomas Jefferson, then Theodore Roosevelt, and finally on the right, Abraham Lincoln. Due to the overall enormity of the project, it spanned several years, and it wasn't completed while Goodson was still alive. The project continued under the supervision of Goodson's son, who was aptly named after Goodson's favorite president. His son, Lincoln Borglum, finally finished the project in South Dakota in October of 1941, which was just a few short months before the bombing of Pearl Harbor. We all have our inspiration. Some are motivated by history. Some find reassurance in the comfort of family and community. There are others who just dream big. Ultimately, it doesn't really matter where you find your motivation or your inspiration. It only matters that you keep pushing forward. Thank you for listening. This has been Entwined. Entwined is a podcast that releases every other week and is written, recorded, edited, and produced by Elliot Gladstone and P.S. McKay. This episode was written by Elliot Gladstone. Please tune in next time to see what P.S. McKay has in store for us. For more information about the show or the authors, please check out entwinedpodcast.com or visit our Twitter page at Entwined Podcast.